Intimacy? Okay, in what regard would you like to talk about intimacy?
Well, the intimacy that we seek on the outside, intimacy on the inside.
And the outside means like in interactions with other people.
Yeah, things that we perceive that are outside of ourselves. That could be people.
And from the
You
inside would be like being honest with yourself, knowing, being intimate with yourself.
yeah, self-inquiry, meditation, intimacy with the self.
Okay. What would you like to explore?
Intimacy with the self.
Well, the two ways of thinking of intimacy that you just raised and we kind of described together are very much interconnected. To a large degree, we know ourselves through what is reflected back to us by other people. Which is it creates some problems, because for one thing, that we can hide from ourselves by projecting some kind of illusion of who we think we'd like to be to other people, and if we convince them and they project it back to us, then we've managed to do a pretty good job of living a lie. That's interesting how that even in that case we can compartmentalize our minds. Some people say everyone has a secret life, by which they mean that somebody that you think you know and understand has another side to them that they don't show to you. And by extension, everybody has a side to them that they don't show to different groups of people they interact with. There's a side of themselves that they don't show to the people they work with, for example. Or that they don't show to all the, well, the public in general, but they maybe have some other group of people with whom they are intimate in a different way that they show that side to. And to that's that description that's put in the terms that everybody has a secret side to them. It's really just a strong form of something else that's much more widespread with all of us. We all present different personas to different people at different times. And so, who is the real person? The interesting thing is that I think for most people, when they're playing one particular role to one particular audience, they're like method actors. They're totally in it. They forget themselves that they have this other side to them. They totally believe it. And then a few hours later, when they're in a different situation, playing a different role to a different audience, the same thing again. And I s switch between these roles. And then if you caught them in the dressing room and said, "By the way, who are you really?" It would really shock them, and they don't know, because they've been doing this for years. They've been doing it so routinely, they don't know who they really are. And they really are all these different personas. But to But they're not really any one of them at the same time. As you get to know yourself, one of the first things that you have to do is begin to acknowledge these different sides to who you are, and that you are all of them, but you are none of them. And as you get to know yourself more deeply, you begin to delve into the question of why you are these different personas in these different situations. I mean, there are some, the answer to which is pretty obvious. A typical person in a work environment, in order for things to go really smoothly, they present certain side of themselves because that's what works with that group of people, the expectations that are put on them, especially if they interact with the public. You think about politicians, you know, the politician, what they present to the public at large, and then who they are to their friends. So some of those are pretty obvious, and they're kind of practical and pragmatic. but it's the ones, the important ones to get to know are the ones that the reason for these different sides to ourselves isn't particularly obvious. And as you begin to penetrate into those and both admit to yourself that there are these different sides to you, and to look at the causes, you discover that some of the things, well, they're the result of certain belief systems that you hold, that you've picked up somewhere along the line. Often as simple as in your young and formative stage of your life, somebody that you really admired and respected held particular beliefs. And so you wanted to be that way. You adopted the view that this is a superior way to be. And so you act that out in certain circumstances, but you're not really that way. And perhaps even though some part of you has doubts about whether that's a good way to be. So that gets acted out in a different circumstance. Some of the ways that we are the result of past emotional, psychological traumas and how we coped with them originally. And so we continue to, in those particular situations, act out that particular role because maybe it worked when you were 12 years old. It takes us a long time to realize that, well, you know, now that I'm 45, it's not really working anymore. I really stand to drop that. When you get to know yourself, you're in a position to actually make that observation and maybe do something about it. But the complex, multifaceted, multi-personality being that the average human person is, it has many parts, and they're built up out of our cumulative past history. Essentially, they're built up out of all of the different experiences that we've had in different situations, all of the different people that we've known, so on and so forth, all the different value judgments that we've made. And a lot of them are incompatible, so they get divided up, just like somebody with multiple personality disorder. They get rearranged, sorted out, and we end up with multiple personalities. And each personality finds a venue where it can play itself out. And that's why you get police chiefs that in their spare time play around with prostitutes and all kinds of other things. You know, you get... Yeah. All the different kinds of things that you can imagine. All the ones that make good tabloid scandal, all the way down to the ones that are so mundane that you just, you know... You feel sorry for somebody that's still trapped in thinking that they've got to hide that part of themselves. One of the things that, as you come to know yourself and it kind of goes beyond just knowing yourself. As you come to know and understand reality in a deeper way, you begin to realign your value systems. And as you do so, you gain something that is very appropriately described as integrity, oneness. As more and more different aspects of yourself become aligned with a consistent value system, and there aren't so many conflicts and contradictions driving your personalities, we acquire an integrity. And a person who has an integrity, has, to the degree that a person has this kind of integrity, they are more consistently the same across a broad range of situations, which doesn't mean that they don't have sense enough not to talk about certain things to certain people or to behave in certain ways in certain groups. But it's no longer coming from a place of slipping into a role and, you know, they know full well that they're modifying their behavior essentially for the smooth functioning of the social interaction that they're in, rather than being trapped by their past conditioning and adopting many different roles, different situations. So that's what I have to say about it. I don't know if it has anything at all to do with what caused you to ask the question.
Oh, I appreciate that sharing the insights that you offer into our inner work, into the self, into the self.
That inner intimacy is hard to come by. We lie to ourselves so much. Our mind plays so many tricks on us. And it's not until you do enough work on yourself to begin to unravel a few of those threads that you have even the least inkling of what your own nature is really like. I would say that if you put together somebody who'd been doing a lot of work on themselves for 40 or 50 years and somebody who's never done a lick at it, both of them would, with equal sincerity, claim that, oh yeah, I have that kind of integrity. I'm just who I am. But I think the difference between them would be rather obvious.
I had an experience this week. You know, I'm like, oh yes, you know, everything is a reflection of myself. So I stopped smoking, you know, mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago. And
congratulations.
It was hard. But what made me do it, like most of it, is I'm very impatient with them. Like, for example, women that get hit by their husbands or something mm-hmm. and then, like, no patience. Like, how come, you know, 20 years and that. And then suddenly I saw, like, wow, it's the same. I have my smoke. And then, you know, it hit in my lungs right afterwards. For 40 years, I couldn't leave it. So I'm like, oh, yes, I'm sympathetic with this woman now. I can understand how hard it is. So then I go and see this rape in the military. 500,000 women get raped in the military every year. Angry. Oh, I was so angry. And then I started, like, feeling like good about ways of torturing these guys in me. Like, wow, what is that all about? Because, you know, that was really interesting that I was like that, that I felt like pleasure on, you know. And the only way in meditation I came and it just couldn't meditate. It was just like in my mind all the time. The only way at the end to get rid of it was I just did open up. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Thank you. Forgive me. I love you. Many, many times until it just left my mind. But like that, I didn't know that capability of myself to be, to get pleasure out of torturing somebody. So I don't know if that's intimacy or like a, something that I learned about myself and
that was rather brilliant of you to see the parallel between being a smoker and somebody trapped in an abusive relationship.
So clear. And then my feeling of impatience with this. And then Allegra says, well, the rapists are like the same thing. They don't want to do it, but they do it.
Yeah.
They keep on doing it. I'm like, oh. Here I am.
And you have to ask yourself the question, why do they do it? And then you have to ignore the first answer that comes up is, oh, well, they're bad people. You have to ignore that.
This is Danny.
Welcome. Just having a little discussion here. A very interesting thing that is a consequence of getting to know ourselves is that we do start to understand everyone else a lot better. One of the Buddhist sutras is called the Satipatthana Sutra, the Four Applications of Mindfulness. And it's really a quite detailed description of a way of meditating on a variety of aspects, including the body and sensations and feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and mental states, and then also the mental perceptions that we generate that make up our reality. And in that sutta, when it's recited, after each new little piece of information is added, there's this particular line that's repeated that the yogi, the person that's practicing this, sees this in himself, sees this in others, sees this in both himself and others. I think it's repeated some, I don't remember exactly, it seemed like 20 some odd times in that sutra. In a way, you could say it's probably the most important line in the sutra. And it's speaking directly to that where we start out, we think we know ourselves, but we don't. We make all kinds of assumptions about other people. We don't really understand them at all. Then as we begin to examine ourselves more deeply and observe ourselves in an honest way, and that's the hard part, is getting honest with yourself. Because like I say, we lie to ourselves all the time. Our mind's very tricky at misrepresenting what's really going on. But as we begin to understand ourselves, what comes from that is we start to see ourselves in other people more and more. People and situations that we would have completely misjudged or denied any similarity, which I imagine probably before your recent experience, you would probably totally denied anything, any possible connection between you and somebody in an abusive relationship, right? There's no way. But then something happened and you saw something in yourself. And once you understood it, you could look at that and say, oh, wow, same thing, right? Seeing yourself in another. And seeing another in yourself. We see things in other people that we don't allow ourselves to see about ourselves. But if you examine other people and their behaviors in an open-minded and open-hearted way, in a place of compassion and caring, like, for example, the rapist you talked about, you start to, from that place of openness, you start to understand them better. You start to see some of the psychological dynamics that drive them and their behaviors. And the same thing happens. As soon as it comes clear in them, it reflects back and you say, oh, wait a minute, I've got that in me too, right? And so it's just, it's absolutely wonderful the way that we can make use of this to understand ourselves better, but also to gain an enormous amount of compassion, ability to forgive. I mean, when you can see yourself in somebody else, it's a lot harder to judge them and demonize them and, dehumanize them. I use a lot more of that in the world.
I'm sorry. Please. This the idea of intimacy and the idea of seeing ourselves and others and that our what's inside us often gets reflected back to us in our relationships. It seems to me that it's so greatly to be desired to have the kinds of relationships or even one where there's enough intimacy and enough honesty that the person that you're in relationship with is willing to tell you how your behavior affects them.
Yeah.
So that you can get an honest reflection of what you're putting out into the world. And then when we get that feedback, it behooves us to stop for a minute and say, oh man, that may be uncomfortable, but wow, this is such an opportunity to see ourselves clearly. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with ourselves about the things that increase suffering in the world, so that we can maybe change them.
Yeah.
And in those situations, I would say, if somebody's telling you something like that, the more defensive you feel about it, the more you really need to look into it.
Mm. Well, that's for sure. Yeah. The more defensive you feel about it, the more of your own hidden agendas are involved that you're not even seeing. But that illustrates how important and valuable a truly intimate relationship is. And a fortunate person has many good friends that they're close to and that they can be intimate in that kind of way with. And of course, the reason that it works best with a number of good friends is because we do have these fractured personalities, and those friends usually represent different sides of ourselves. But there's something very special about that one-on-one relationship, that special kind of intimacy that's built over time, when two people get to know absolutely every most microscopic detail of each other. I mean, not that anybody really ever knows somebody else, but certainly in that kind of intimate one-on-one relationship, we certainly know those two people know each other better than either of them does anyone else, and in some ways, including themselves. And that's where you really get this mirroring back and forth, because in that relationship, one partner can see things in their partner that that person can't see themselves, and vice versa. Not only that, there's that experience which anybody in a relationship has where you realize that your partner is beginning to know you in a way that no one else has, and that you really haven't known yourself. And it's very scary. And that's when you feel the defensiveness coming up. It's like, go away. I don't want you to go there. I haven't been there myself yet. I don't know what's in there. I'm not sure I'm willing to let anybody else see that. Yeah. But that's the wonderful thing about the relationship is that if two people can interact in that way, the wonderful way that they can help each other in their mutual self-development and self-revelation and mutual discovery, and the way that they can support each other. Maybe that's the most important thing, is how when we truly love somebody, we're willing to support them rather than judge them. And that just promotes inner growth in a super fabulous way. And it's interesting how people come together. I think it was you that mentioned this the other day, that we've all heard it many times. A couple comes together in a relationship and the man expects the woman's going to always stay the same, and the woman expects that the man's going to change.
It's like a remodeling project.
But the woman changes and the man doesn't. And also, we form these relationships for all kinds of selfish reasons. Needs we have, and you make me feel better about myself in this way, and I'll make you feel better about yourself in that way, and it's really more a business transaction and a bargain, and we'll both do better and be happier and everything like that. You have to go so far from that starting place to get to a place of true intimacy. I think you actually have to reach a point, probably multiple occasions, where the relationship as transaction no longer works because you're definitely in a place where it's costing you more than you're getting. Yeah, and we go through those. And it's only by going through those repeatedly that we really build the loving and caring. So, okay, I'm no longer in this because of the benefit I'm getting. There's a different reason. And that's when it really becomes strong. And that's when it deepens. And you get past that to the other side, and then of course you're both getting multifold more than ever from the relationship. And every time that happens, it deepens. The unfortunate thing is that it's so easy in these relationships to reach that point where what you're getting isn't worth what you're putting into it. You say, okay, this isn't working for me anymore, so long. And we don't follow through from that point. Of course, that's not always bad, too, because we form these relationships when we're so young and ignorant. They're mostly poor choices to begin with anyway. But as we evolve, hopefully, we can form a bond with somebody who can really be a partner for spiritual growth, and we can support each other. We can reflect each other back. In which case, intimacy with the other becomes a way to achieve intimacy with yourself. This is something that monastics only get a limited opportunity to experience. Granted, a group of men or women living the same place in a small community can and hopefully do form bonds of intimacy, and some of this goes on. But the level at which it can take place, when two people form that kind of union and are in the presence of each other throughout all kinds of situations, day in and day out, very special. Actually, the other night, Thursday night after the Dharma talk in Tucson, some young people took me out to get a bite to eat. Didn't have any transportation or food, so And what they wanted to talk about was polyamory, not multiple sex partners for the sake of sex, but rather having multiple love relationships. They asked me what I thought about it. My first response was, the only thing messy and more time and energy consuming than a relationship with one person is a relationship with more than
how it complicates your life.
But as we continue to talk, of course, and it's related to that, it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of energy and it's draining. And it would be a really, really unusual person that could even approach that kind of depth of intimacy with more than one person at a time. I'm not even sure it's possible. I don't know that a human being would have the internal resources to sustain that kind of intimacy for very long with more than one person. But on the other hand, sex and friendship, those are easy. And as a matter of fact, the modern trend is to have multiple sexual partners, you know, friends with privileges, or privileges or benefits, friends with benefits, and multiple close friends that you don't have sex with, but you can share all that other kind of intimate stuff with. You keep them compartmentalized so that they, you know, it's not quite so messy that way.
And it seems like more people and young people are drawn to and inquiring about polyamory and that kind of a relationship for the possibility of deepening maybe their own self-inquiry relationship with people.
Yeah, I think it's an inevitable thing to explore. It really all started in the 60s with birth control becoming readily available. And there was a whole sexual revolution and exploring sexuality. And then there was a wave of people experimenting with open marriage and three-way and four-way relationships and things like that, which gave us all collectively the opportunity to discover just how complex these things are, because you know, we've matured a lot from those days in terms of understanding it just ain't that simple. You can't just go and do those kinds of things and not expect there to be all kinds of problems and repercussions. So, but it's first came the sexual liberation, and now more recently is more of the social liberation, where talking about these things, portraying them on television, people being in unusual relationships is becoming more and more acceptable at a social level. And so it allows us to explore them. So who knows where it's going to go and what it's going to lead to in the end. But the exploration will naturally reveal all kinds of problems that are not foreseen and all kinds of benefits and ways to grow that come from it. I mean, how often, probably everybody in this room knows of people who've intentionally or unintentionally experimented with open sexual relationships and discovered how much they can learn from dealing with their own jealousy. But at the same time, you probably know that it never really worked out for any of them. So it's got a good side and its bad side. You can learn a lot about yourself and your partner by trying to deal with jealousy and possessiveness and things like that. But in most cases, it's going to blow the relationship apart, and you're going to have to take the lessons you learned to some new place in the future to apply them. We grow and we come to know more. I suppose you could say basically through our mistakes. we're all like children. We got to try what we haven't tried and learn from it.
Does it have the possibility of working for some people? Has it worked? Has it made them grow more on their spiritual path, possibly? Or possibly you could just be using it to fool yourself on your spiritual path.
Yeah. But, works both ways for sure.
In my experience, I've known people that practice poly, and some of them, as I see it, there's this really hard work that happens, and there's possibly going away from it. But I also have seen people that have stayed in it and have grown from it, and have it appears that they have opened their heart more into love and intimacy in their older age.
Yeah. And yeah, and trying to understand the difference between those individuals, who are comparatively rare, and all the other people for whom it just doesn't work. That's really important. When we understand what's the difference, then we have something that we can really work with. But you know, where we really want to go is that place of having a genuine love for other people, for multiple other people, that selfless love that doesn't come from what do I get from our relationship, but comes from loving the other person for who and what they are. And when we grow to the point that we have that kind of love for everyone around us, now that's the real spiritual development, when you even have that kind of love for strangers or for people that attack you, then you know that it's spiritual growth. And it's something, at that point, it has left sexuality so far behind that it has absolutely nothing to do with it anymore.
What about the opposite end of the spectrum? I mean, just, you know, sometimes we're single for a long stretch. Yeah. My grandmother's been single since 1982. Mm-hmm. So she's not celibate. She's not a monastic.
Yeah.
She's just single.
Well, a lot of people are choosing not to be in those kinds of relationships anymore. That's another one of the possibilities that's opened up. At the same time, we have needs for intimacy and for not just emotional intimacy, but sexual intimacy. And what I see is people who are making that decision are often satisfying the need for sexual intimacy with different set of friends than the ones they satisfy, but through which they satisfy their need for emotional intimacy, because that's pretty well necessary in order to maintain that kind of independence. If you make the resolve that I'm single and I want to stay single, but I want to have people in my life that I love and care for and close to, and I want to be able to have sex with people when I want to, you almost have to separate those two, because if you don't, you know, the person that you're having both kinds of intimacy with wants exactly what you are not willing to give them.
That seems actually like back to polyamory. I mean, just maybe a sort of a slowed down polyamory.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, sometimes right. You just, you know.
Yeah. Well, I, as a matter of fact, I'd say it's probably the most successful way that people can experience polyamory is to have multiple emotionally intimate relationships and multiple sexually intimate relationships, but not let them overlap. Because as soon as they overlap, you've got all the complications that come from human nature. I mean, we're genetically programmed to bonds, you know, so we can make babies and stuff. And so if there's a person in the mix that's made the resolve that they don't want to do that, then there's going to be problem right away. It also, there's also the whole cultural thing. I mean, everybody see two people with this kind of intimacy and they're a couple, right? And they're treated like a couple, and creates all kinds of things. Like, well, one of the things that too you see is a woman who chooses not to be in that sort of committed one-on-one relationship has no problem obtaining the intimacy that she needs from other men and women, because for whatever reason, men don't have great hesitation to have sex with a woman just because she has another partner somewhere else. It's just the opposite for a man in that. As soon as a potential sexual partner finds out that he's also got another sexual partner, it's like, forget it, guy, you know, on your way. It was nice knowing you. And the intimacy thing, too, when it comes to the emotional side of it, it's easier for a woman to have emotional intimacy with other women, because when you have it with men, well, they say, I want the sexual part of it too. And if you're trying to live that kind of life where you're keeping the two separate, then you know, it's a problem. Men, on the other hand, have trouble having that kind of intimacy with other men.
Yeah.
It's safe. So they tend to look for emotional intimacy with other women, but it's the same thing. Okay, the woman says, if we're going to be this intimate emotionally, shouldn't we be bonded? Shouldn't we declare to everyone that we're a couple? You know, and the guy's saying, well, but no, that's, I don't want to go there.
I guess I'm curious about something a little bit different.
Yeah.
The sort of the model you presented at the beginning is a partner relationship where sexuality is an important component for deepening the intimacy, with the intimacy being primary.
Yeah.
And then, but, you know, there are times, stretches in our lives where the sexuality component just isn't an option, at least not in an overt way.
Right.
Not there for years at a time. You know, it's not the same as being a monastic exactly. You're not, you haven't taken a vow. You're not, you know, you haven't renounced sex exactly. You just, it just isn't happening.
Right.
And so I guess I would be, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that a person would have to, you know, go on a singles cruise, like before they could get on with any kind of meaningful work on themselves, or, you know, they would need to be, you know, combing the classified ads for a partner or something, getting drunk and going to a bar at closing time, you know. So what about those stretches? What we're just, it's just, you know, just me, myself, and I.
Yeah. I know that in some people, I see that as something very beneficial that they go through. They accept the fact that this isn't happening for me right now. And so they stop engaging in those activities that are trying to pursue that. They just accept it. It is an opportunity for them. It is me, myself, and I. They get to know themselves a lot better. They get, you know, in the ongoing pursuit of relationship, we don't know ourselves, and every potential partner we get involved with, we start to make various kinds of compromises, which are basically misrepresentations of who we are and what our values are. And we don't have the opportunity, because we go from one potential hopeful partnership situation, doesn't work out, and we go on to the next and the next and the next. We never get that break to really look inside and reflect on those things and see what they have to tell us. So sometimes those periods where it just ain't happening can be wonderful. A person says, okay, it ain't happening for the time being. I'm going to stop running around trying to make it happen. Instead, I'll get to know who I am. And sometimes it's with a specific purpose of understanding why it's not happening. There's kind of an interesting thing in there, though. One observation I have is that there's all different kinds of personalities of men and women with all different degrees of, for lack of a better word, likableness to them. And yet somehow or another, they Most of them end up being able to be in relationships. And of course, there's all kinds of different degrees of beauty and ugliness or deformity or whatever else from the physical level. And the same thing, you find the deformed and the obese are very often in relationships as much as the ones that look like that they should be on a model runway or should be a star in an action movie or something, you know. But then there are always those people that you see who you look at them and you can't imagine why they're not in a relationship, but they really have a problem. They say, it just never works out for me. You know, I meet people and get to know them a little bit, it just never works out for me. And that's really an interesting thing. Like, what is it? How did these people, on the one hand, that seem, from a market point of view, undesirable, they've got partners. And on the other hand, these people that seem like they should be so attractive, they can't seem to form a relationship no matter what. But I'd say in the more general case, that having those periods of aloneness, they're very valuable opportunities. If the person can see them as that, rather than, as you say, answering all the ads in the newspaper and hanging out bars at closing time and stuff like that. I mean, you either get desperate to change the situation or you accept the situation and learn what it has to tell you.
Sounds responsible.
What's that?
That sounds responsible. I agree with you.
Yeah.
With what?
Most of the time, we don't behave responsibly and reasonably. We act out of our emotions. I want to get laid.
Yeah. Well, how about that idea? There is no other.
Well,
I mean that truth that you are there. You are the only one. You're it, the whole thing. Your consciousness is it.
Not your ego.
But not your,
ego, but you're the whole greater thing. You're creating this other or not other or whatever, but they're not real.
Yeah, well, it's
anyway.
Where you really want to get to is where all these other people you see, you know, we're one, you know, and it's that love, that acceptance, you know.
Isn't that the intimacy?
That's the true intimacy. That's the intimacy that we're reaching for in all these other ways.
That's why we're doing all this
stuff. That's why we're doing it all. Yeah. Yeah.
When one is inquiring into the self through meditation or inquiring into intimacy, what would be a question to meditate on?
Well, the simplest question of all is who am I? What is the self? And as a matter of fact, in the Advaita Vedanta, that is really the essence of the whole practice. It's just, you just keep asking yourself, who am I? And every time you get an answer, you say, okay, who am I really?
Who am I not?
Yeah. Well, the way I would put it would be a little differently. The question, who am I, makes the supposition that you really are the separate self you think you are. And by pursuing the answer to the question, you discover that you aren't that. Well, I would suggest we could kind of skip the first part of the process and not even assume that you are the separate self that you believe you are, and just ask just instead the question, what's really going on here?
What is it from that? The watu, the koan, what is it? Yeah. So yeah. It's the objective thing.
Yeah.
You know, about.
Yeah. What is it?
What is it? Is the koan?
Yeah. What is it?
Yeah.
Or what is this and where did it happen? Yeah. Slightly expanded. But it's the same question.
It is the same question. Yeah.
I like something that Scott Kelleby said. You are not a person living in time and space. You are the present awareness from which that story arises.
That puts it very well. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And as Byron Katie puts it, who would you be without your story? Remove the story and what's left. Okay. Well, this has been a great discussion. So let's take a little break and then we'll sit together. Okay.